Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning. Thank you for joining me for another exciting episode of New Book Network's African American Studies podcast. Today, I am joined by Dean Tomiko Brown-Nagin, author of Civil Rights Queen, Constance Baker Motley, and The Struggle for Equality. Dean Brown-Nagin is Dean of Harvard Radcliffe Institute, one of the world's leading centers for interdisciplinary research across the humanities, sciences, social sciences, arts, and professions. She's also the Daniel P.S. Paul Professor of Constitutional Law at Harvard Law School and a Professor of History at Harvard University. She's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the American Law Institute, and the American Philosophical Society, a Fellow of the American Bar Foundation, a distinguished lecturer for the Organization of American Historians, and a member of the Board of Directors of ProPublica. Dean Brown-Nagin has published articles and book chapters on a wide range of topics, including the Supreme Court's Equal Protection Jurisprudence, Civil Rights Law and History, and the Affordable Care Act. She is a contributing editor of Politico magazine. Her first book, Courage to Dissent, Atlanta and the Long History of the Civil Rights Movement, won the 2002 Bancroft Prize in American History. Today, we will be discussing her second book, Civil Rights Queen, Constance Baker Motley, and the Struggle for Equality. Thank you for joining me today, Dean Brown-Nagin.
It's my pleasure.
Can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Sure. Civil Rights Queen is a book about Constance Baker Motley, who was a pathbreaking civil rights lawyer, politician, and judge. In fact, she was the first Black woman appointed to the federal courts. And I use her life and work to discuss social change and legal change in 20th century America. She is a person who both embodied change herself because she was personally a pathbreaker, but also helped to bring about social and legal change for others. And so she was a very appealing subject for a biography.
How did you become interested in Constance Baker Motley?
Sure. Well, I had long known about Constance Baker Motley, but it was not until I was writing Courage to Dissent, Atlanta, and the Long History of the Civil Rights Movement that I looked in depth at her work and legacy. And I did that because she is the lawyer who argued the Atlanta school desegregation case all the way to the Supreme Court successfully. And I approached the chapter on that case with the intention of writing a biographical sketch of Motley, as I did for all of the lawyers who were part of that book project. And what I noticed at the time is that there was relatively little a scholarly engagement with Motley and her legacy. And I thought that it was, as I mentioned in the introduction to Civil Rights Queen, a kind of historical malpractice to overlook her or to minimize her to the extent that I found in the literature at the time. And so I set about writing about this extraordinarily fascinating and impactful lawyer.
How difficult was it to reconstruct Motley's life, or was it? What challenges did you face as a writer, as a scholar, in creating this text?
Sure. I would say that there are many, many sources, archival papers about Motley's life and work held by the Library of Congress, the Sophia Smith Archives, Columbia, NYU. In addition, there were some personal papers that I found from with the help of family members. The thing that was difficult, I will say, is researching and recreating her internal life. And that's for two reasons that are intersecting reasons. One, it turns out that judges in general are very cautious about revealing their internal thoughts or internal world. And that's because there is this truism that judges are only influenced by the law itself. And so they don't want to leave a lot behind to reveal their thoughts. And then compounding that was the reality that Constance Baker Motley was a pretty private person not a person whom I would call terribly introspective. And so she, as an individual, was hard to get to know. And so what I had to do was to ensure that I conducted a lot of oral history interviews with family members, with former colleagues, with really anyone I could find who knew her. And I was able to piece together her personality and to make that a part of the book. And I'm happy that I was able to do that because it's really a requirement for a biography to be able to say a bit about the person's personality, how she interacted with others. And I'm very happy with what I was able to achieve. And again, thanks in part to my ability to speak to her family members and do research about her family.
I would like to say you did that successfully well, because I was drawn in into her story, into her life.
Terrific. I'm glad.
Let's begin by taking a look at her early years, some of what shaped her. So how did Motley's parents' identity as immigrants from Nevis shape her childhood?
Sure. Motley's family did immigrate from the island of Nevis in the West Indies. And they thought of themselves, both the mom and the father, as special people. In fact, the father, given his racial background, he was mixed race and also worked as a skilled tradesman on Nevis, was literally called a special person. He was a part of a class of people who are identified as special people. They also identified with the British Empire. They were pleased, they said, to be subjects of the British Empire. They thought of themselves as a class apart from American Blacks. They were socially conservative, culturally conservative, and passed all of these characteristics down to Motley. And in particular, I want to point out that on the subject of the relationship to American Blacks, Motley's father in particular was viewed Black Americans, including the migrants from the South who landed in New Haven, where the Nemissians also landed in their family, quite unfavorably. He would not allow his children to play with the children of Black migrants, and really thought that these Southerners had allowed themselves to be debased by segregation. So it was quite a caricature of American race relations. And it is, I say in the book, even either despite or because of her father's low opinion of American Blacks that Constance Baker Motley grew up to be the civil rights queen. Much of her work did have a positive impact on American Blacks. So it's quite an interesting story there.
That it is. Now, growing up in Connecticut, Motley's childhood, you mentioned, was a studying contrast between the North and the South.
Yes. Well, she certainly did view it that way. And there was some truth in her understanding that the North and the South were completely different. Of course, it was Jim Crow segregation in the South. Generally, by the time Motley came along, that was not the case in New Haven, Connecticut. And yet, a point that I make in my book is that there certainly was discrimination against Blacks in the state of Connecticut. They were limited in terms of the occupations that they could pursue. So her father and virtually all of the men in her family worked as servants at Yale University. Blacks were not invited to work in the high-paying industries, including the munitions industry in Connecticut. She also recounts one incident of discrimination, racial discrimination, where she was not allowed to use a public beach in Connecticut. And there were lots of other factors that undercut her sense that life in Connecticut was so different from life in the Deep South. And of course it was. The point that I make in my book is that it's important not to paint too rosy a picture of her circumstances in Connecticut, including because she faced a lot of barriers, much of them connected to her class background, but of course class and race are connected themselves.
Very true. Motley, she grew up during the 1930s. How did the Great Depression and the emergence of left-leaning politics shape her identity?
Right. So the Great Depression was an era of profound class disadvantage that gave rise to a lot of activism around that subject and a lot of left-leaning activism, which Motley witnessed. She participated in some of it. She was a part of groups that represented the interests of the working class, pro-union groups, and also became acquainted with the struggle for racial equality during this time. So the point that I make is that that flourishing political moment during the Great Depression and after had a profound impact on Motley's sense of herself. She developed an interest in reform movements as a result of her coming of age experience, and thus that experience is fundamental to understanding the trajectory of her life and how she became an activist and became a lawyer. It was the right place for her, she thought, to channel her activism. And it's really important then to understand how the Great Depression shaped her throughout the course of her life.
Once Motley graduated from high school, her goals for life different from those of her parents. What did she want that caused conflict within an otherwise close-knit family?
Yes. Well, what she wanted, first of all, was to attend college. And this was a very lofty and unusual aspiration for a working class Black girl in Connecticut, New Haven, Connecticut at that time, immigrant or not. And moreover, she got this idea that she wanted to attend law school, which was fantastical for a person like her. And her parents did think that both aspirations were silly. And her mom told her that she should pursue a career, a vocation that was more practical in nature. She encouraged her daughter to become a hairdresser. And although being a stylist was certainly a worthy aspiration, it was very different from what Motley wanted for herself. And fortunately, she was able to achieve those dreams through the support of a New Haven philanthropist who heard her speak at a civic organization when she was still a teenager. And as a result of being so impressed with her, offered to subsidize her college and pay for her law school expenses. And so she said that it was like a fairy tale. And indeed, it was a life-changing intervention.
Very true. Initially, Motley chose to go to Fisk, and she traveled from New Haven to Tennessee. How much of that raised her awareness about racism that was occurring during this time?
Yes, the experience of having to change to the Jim Crow car, she found humiliating. It was frightening. And then once she arrived in Nashville, of course, she also was subject to the experience of Jim Crow segregation, and she didn't like it. And of course, it fueled her ambition to do something about this terrible inequality, which she ended up doing just that through her career as a civil rights lawyer, and eventually transferred from Fisk to NYU, in part because Fisk was much quieter than she had expected. This was because of the war. Many professors and others had were not on campus because they were on the war front. And also she found Fisk less politically engaging than she wanted. As I've explained, she was quite a politically conscious, socially conscious person. She wanted to be involved, and she found that many of the students at Fisk, some of whom were very unlike her in terms of their class background, just were not as socially engaged. And so she wanted to go back to New York, and she did, to be on a campus that was quite socially engaged, and that was NYU.
And she completed her degree at NYU, and she entered into Columbia Law School. What was that environment like, given that it was 1944? You mentioned how Fisk and with the war, what was happening. Did something similar happen at Columbia during this time?
Sure. Well, I would say that she certainly was her chances for attending Columbia Law School were increased because there are so many men who, again, were on the war front. And so Columbia did admit a handful of women and also a handful of people of color. And yet the experience was not terribly engaging for her. She experienced law school as rather boring. Of course, this was before there was a civil rights curriculum. And so she just wasn't that engaged by law school. And in addition, it wasn't a terribly inviting environment for women. This was the era when female students were thought to not belong and were either ignored by professors or they were they were subject to Women's Day when they were expected to be on call. And so it was not a, great environment for her. And she was happy to graduate and to find find an ability to pursue her passion for social change through employment at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
What was it like for her working with Thurgood Marshall?
Well, the first thing I will say is that Marshall hired her on the spot when she came to his office seeking an internship. And this was a very different experience from her attempts to find employment in New York City law firms, where the partner, took one look at her and closed the door. So it was not very welcoming. And this was, of course, a common experience for the few women law school graduates at the time. In fact, it continued to be a common experience for them. Ruth Bader Ginsburg tells a similar story. Sandra Day O'Connor told a similar story about the lack of opportunities. And so it was terrific to be invited by Thurgood Marshall to work at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, to be told about his experiences working with women who were engaged in, say, public school teaching. He was a warm colleague, although, as I describe in my book, there were several instances of Motley experiencing the same kind of limitations based on gender that any woman experienced at the time.
As the time of her professional life begins to take off, there were some changes in her personal life as well. She gets married, yet Motley does not seem to have that traditional marriage for the time period.
That's right. I do tell a story about her marriage to Joel Wilson Motley and how it was a companionate marriage. He supported her at a time when it was just uncommon to have what I describe as a more or less egalitarian marriage. Of course, it was helpful that his profession was real estate. He had his own firm, which meant that there he had a pretty flexible employment arrangement. And so he not only supported her by later on ferrying her to work every day and back, but he also was a partner in the raising of their one child, which of course is was quite beneficial to Motley's ability to do her work.
In 1949, Motley had her first court appearance as a trial lawyer in the case of Bates versus Batt in Mississippi. What was that experience like for her? And it comes to mind as I'm thinking about this, the reference that you made of one of the few Black lawyers in Mississippi, James Burns, and his subservient attitude. What was that like for Motley to experience that?
Yes. Well, it was both an exhilarating experience to be trying a case in Jackson, Mississippi, and it also was a frightening and very challenging experience because she not only was a Black lawyer, she was a Black woman lawyer. So the folks of Mississippi were not accustomed to this. And she, in particular, caused a scene when she walked along the streets of Jackson, Mississippi. She was trying the case with her fellow lawyer, Robert Carter, a Black lawyer of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And even as they were challenging segregation, they were subject to segregation in Jackson. So they couldn't stay in white-owned hotels. They could not eat food served by white restaurants. I tell a story about how they couldn't even, they were treated disrespectfully by a white proprietors, including at a fruit stand, which angered Motley, but she understood that she had to abide by the social norms of the day. At the same time, of course, she and her co-counsel were transgressive by going into the courtroom and standing up to the judge and asking, interrogating white officials who were holding the line by paying Black teachers less than white ones, regardless of their qualifications. And the contrast between Motley's transgressiveness and what was expected of Black people, including the handful of Black lawyers who were practicing in the South, was illustrated by this co-counsel, Jess Brown, who, even as he was the local counsel for the NAACP, illustrated his subservience to whites by never turning his back on the judge and also walking bent at the waist away from the bench. And it was just extraordinary. And he also was very clearly frightened by the experience of being seen as an ally of these Black lawyers from New York. Which is a way of saying that this was a dangerous assignment for Motley and Carter to challenge the system of racial oppression in the way that they were. This case resulted in a backlash, retaliation against the Black teacher who challenged the pay scale. She ended up having to move out of the state. And I have to say that Motley and Carter were lucky to leave the state alive. And that was generally the experience, I would say, of her practice life in Mississippi. And she did, as I recount in the book, she tried several cases in Mississippi and Alabama, places where it was dangerous to be a civil rights lawyer.
Very true. She also, as she fought for equal pay in Mississippi, she also came back and fought for equal pay at the LDF. What happened in that situation?
Yes, well, it was ironic that after she had led this case challenging unequal pay for African-American teachers in Jackson, she came back to the offices of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in New York and challenged Thurgood Marshall, saying that she was not paid what she should have been given her years of experience, nor did she have the title that was appropriate given the functions that she was performing at the LDF. And so she essentially challenged a form of discrimination on her own behalf, and fortunately ended up prevailing in that challenge. But it just says, it says everything really about her peculiar position as a lawyer who essentially, she was fighting battles on behalf of her clients, fighting similar battles for herself. She was quite a pathbreaker.
That she was. And she was also involved in the landmark case of Brown versus Board of Education. Yet her role is sometimes minimized. How did she assist with the case?
Yes. Well, Motley formed, wrote the first complaint in the set of cases that challenge segregation in schools. And she also was vital in conducting research in support of the cases as they wound through the courts. She was very much a part of the team doing this important research. She was listed on the briefs that were filed in Brown versus Board of Education when it was argued at the Supreme Court twice. And yet she was not an oralist at the Supreme Court And so in the history book, she's not, until now, she's not been accorded the credit that I believe that she was due. And so that's what the chapter on her role in Brown is all about, describing how it's not only the lawyers who argued at the Supreme Court who rightfully should be remembered, but Motley as well for the work that she did, including because after Brown was decided unanimously, it fell to her to litigate dozens of cases in the Deep South to actually implement the rule that mandatory segregation by race in public schools was no longer lawful.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Very true. As you mentioned, Motley continued her work on desegregation following Brown. There are cases against the University of Florida, University of Alabama, University of Georgia, and she was also personally involved in the lives of her clients. Can you tell us a little bit about how those pioneering cases in the fight of desegregation impacted the plaintiffs, such as Polly Ann Myers, Authoring Lucy, James Meredith? How difficult and challenging was that environment for these plaintiffs during this time?
Sure. Well, a point that I make in my book is that these cases were very challenging, very difficult for the named plaintiffs. There was a human toll of these landmark civil rights cases that we don't often describe. And I go to some length to describe in all of those cases the difficulties that the plaintiffs faced. And in the University of Alabama case involving Polly Ann Meyer and Authoring Lucy, I described how Meyer was dropped from the case without any protest from Motley and other NAACP lawyers. And she was dropped because the school, the university, learned that she had a child before she was married, which violated the norms of respectability. It was viewed as a character defect, and she was unceremoniously dropped from the case, which meant that Authoring Lucy, who had very much depended on Polly Ann for support, was left to fend by herself. And ultimately, the backlash proved too much. She was subjected to violence, to epithets, and she couldn't take it. And so that first University of Alabama case ended in a defeat for the Legal Defense Fund. It had to be litigated a second time in the 1960s, which is when the school was desegregated. And that was no easy feat either, by the way. I discuss how the James Meredith case took a toll. This is the case against Ole Miss, took quite a toll on Meredith as well as on Motley. It was an incredibly hard fought case where even federal judges who understood intellectually that the the university would have to be desegregated because, after all, this case is brought well after Brown versus Board of Education, after other cases, made it clear that that the law would require the desegregation of the school. But nevertheless, there was just a united front of opposition by segregationists in Mississippi against Meredith. They attacked his character. They retaliated against him. They claimed that he had engaged in voter fraud, which should sound familiar even today. So just an effort to wear him down, which was also an effort to wear her down. And I describe how she had to go to great lengths to be supportive of Meredith, and how there came a time when he just gave up, and he had to be essentially made to endure. And we're happy that he did, because eventually, by virtue of a Supreme Court order, James Meredith was ordered into the university. And yet, even then, there was lots of backlash, and an individual lost his life as a result of that fight to integrate Ole Miss. And these are the stories about these cases that I believe we ought to know, in addition to understanding that they were landmark cases that resulted in African-American students and others being able to attend these flagship universities today. And it was no easy road for the plaintiffs or the lawyers.
I agree. These are cases, and we do need to know more about these plaintiffs. In 1961, when Thurgood Marshall was appointed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, Motley suffered a setback, a professional setback, when he chose Jack Green, a white civil rights attorney, as his successor. How did Motley respond to this challenge?
Right. It's Jack Greenberg, and Marshall endorsed Greenberg for his position, and the board ultimately appointed him. Motley was disappointed, as were many Black lawyers. She thought that she deserved the role. There were other Black lawyers, including Bob Carter, who might have been appointed to director counsel of the NAACP. None of them were. Motley responded with disappointment, but she carried on, which is what she always did. She didn't think it was fair. She didn't think it was right, but she was given a sort of consolation prize in that she was appointed number two to Jack Greenberg. And yet the story I tell is that the denial of this opportunity did open Motley up to other opportunities, including a career in politics. And in the final analysis, she was able to achieve a prestigious position to the appointment to the judiciary. But it was quite a disappointment for her, because she did know that Thurgood Marshall, her mentor, had a hand in this biggest setback of her career to that point. And so it was just it was a sad time for her.
Now, Motley, she also suffered sadness for other reasons, because she was intimately acquainted with some pioneers of the civil rights movement, such as Medgar Evers, and his death and the impact of that on her. And she also worked with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. How did those relationships shape her in many respects?
Well, Medgar Evers, who was the head of the NAACP in Mississippi, was a friend to Motley and a companion when she flew back and forth between New York and Mississippi to litigate the Meredith case. He would pick her up from the airport. He would invite her to be a part of the community. She stayed with Medgar and Merle, his wife, and their children when she visited Mississippi to litigate. And as I mentioned, this is a very dangerous assignment. And so it was so helpful to have his support when she was in the state. As I describe in the book, after Motley left Mississippi, after she had finished litigating the Meredith case, Medgar Evers was assassinated. And it was a crushing defeat for Motley. She lost her friend, and his assassination really drove home to her how dangerous that assignment was. She could have been killed herself, and she was just so devastated by his death, and in fact, so devastated that she couldn't bring herself to attend his funeral. She remained behind in New York in bed, and it was just a crushing blow for her. By contrast, the story that I tell about Motley and Dr. King is one of deep friendship and an interaction by King with a female professional that taught him the lesson that women could be leaders, that he could depend on a woman to rescue him. She represented him several times, including in Birmingham. And it's a terrific story to tell because it does stand in contrast to other stories that we've heard about King and how he was a disappointment to leaders like Ella Baker, who famously said that King had feet of clay because he didn't rise to the occasion in her view. He wasn't the community leader that she thought Ella Baker thought he should be, and didn't recognize her and other women leaders in the way that he ought to have. And yet Motley is a different story. And I explained that in part, the reason that King was able to recognize Motley was because she was occupying a traditionally male role as a lawyer. And so he does get proper credit for recognizing Motley, and yet his ability to get along with her, to admire her, does not really take away from the critique lodged by people like Ella Baker, who are working in his own organization and did not receive the proper credit due.
Very true. As I was reading your chapters, especially as Motley was working in the courtroom as a litigator, I wish I could have seen her. What was she like in the courtroom? What are the stories that you were able to learn about her in the courtroom?
Well, the first thing that must be said about Motley is that she is very tall, nearly 6 feet tall. And she was physically striking. She was attractive, or a handsome woman, as would have been said at the time. And all of these attributes were helpful given the environment that she encountered in courtrooms, where she often was the only woman, the only person of color, or perhaps one of two. So it helped to be physically commanding under those circumstances. She did encounter a lot of hostility from co-counsel. I describe how when she was litigating the Meredith case, the counsel representing the state of Mississippi would not shake her hand. She put out her hand once, and it just hung out there because he would not touch her, which she thought was curious because she did not feel inferior. She had not routinely experienced this kind of treatment. And so it was disappointing to her. He would not call her by her proper honorific, Mrs. Motley. I recount how she challenged him and said to the judge, who himself was a segregationist, if he couldn't call, this counsel couldn't call her by her proper name, he shouldn't refer to her at all. And so there were many, many moments like this, but ultimately the impression that one should take away is of Motley being a kind of warrior for social justice and confronting the challenges that awaited her in the courtroom always. She was very strong. She was unflappable and was a terrific courtroom litigator.
As I said, I wish I could have seen that because it would have served as so much inspiration, especially to women, to Black women during this time period and to others. Now, she moves on from litigating to actually her involvement in politics. How did she become involved in politics?
Well, one thing I want to say, just going back to the notion of seeing her, I do include quite a few photographs in the book. There also is audio available of some of Motley's Supreme Court oral arguments. And when I give presentations on my book, I do sometimes play some of that audio because I think it's important to hear how steady her voice is and how commanding she is. So there's that if you want to take a listen.
I would, so, most definitely.
Yes. So you were asking me about how she became involved in politics. Well, as I said, she did experience that setback at the Legal Defense Fund, which opened her to the possibility of entertaining the entreaties, numerous entreaties that she received over time to stand for political office. And why were people asking her to do this? Well, because she had name recognition, which is vital for success in politics. And also she had a reputation for excellence. And so she was essentially worn down by New York politicos who wanted her to run for office. She did end up standing for the New York Senate. She won a seat in the New York Senate, the first Black woman to do so. And then really the crown in her political career was being elected Manhattan Borough President. She's the first woman to be so elected. And it was controversial in some quarters. So as you can imagine, there were Democrats in New York City and New York State, including in Harlem, some men who were not that interested in her invading their lane, so to speak. And they articulated that they didn't see her as a legitimate representative of Blacks in particular, and yet she was able to win those offices. And in her capacity as an office holder, she did continue to fight for social justice. And through her control as Manhattan Borough President of the budget, she had a lot of influence over the budget. Of course, it's through the budget that one is able to fund social programs. She also funded revitalization programs for Harlem. And so I view her as having been quite effective as a politician, although she was only only held office for a very short period of time before being plucked for the federal judiciary.
Very true. Now, she became the first Black woman nominated as a federal judge. Unfortunately, it wasn't without controversy. How so?
Yes. Well, Lyndon Baines Johnson nominated her for the federal judiciary and originally wanted to appoint her to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. There was blowback against that because she believed she was a woman. But it also was because of her race, really combined race and gender. She had a lot of detractors who wanted to see someone else appointed. These are very prestigious positions, and there were lots of lawyers in New York who wanted the seat for themselves. She had famous detractors for this appointment, including Senator Kennedy, who wanted a white man appointed. He thought it was too politically sensitive to have two Black NAACP lawyers, Motley and Marshall, sitting on the federal bench. And so LBJ ended up appointing her to the U.S. District Court. That still was controversial for many of the same reasons. And in addition, there were segregationists who opposed her, including Senator James Eastland, head of the Judiciary Committee. Eastland was an alum of Ole Miss and did not want to see the person who was responsible for its integration being a federal judge. And he put up all kinds of roadblocks, held up her appointment for 7 months, but ultimately she was confirmed to the federal judiciary, achieving an historic first.
Very true. And as I was reading, there were three cases that stuck in my mind. The case of Martin Sostrer, the Blank v. Sullivan and Cromwell case, and the case of Melissa Ludke. And it made me wonder, as I was reading, about Motley's perspective on her cases. As a judge, and I know you mentioned that judges often didn't reveal their internal thoughts, but could you get a sense of, were there certain cases that Motley presided over that she was particularly proud of or that she felt connected to her?
Sure. The Sostre case, Martin Sostre case, was one that she was very proud of. And this was a case involving a jailhouse lawyer, a Black Puerto Rican man who was in prison on trumped up drug charges, who was placed in solitary confinement because of retaliation against his prison activism, he alleged, and he filed a lawsuit challenging as cruel and unusual punishment the confinement to solitary. And Motley drew his case. She decided in his favor, actually awarded him damages. And the law enforcement community was not pleased with this outcome. And yet Motley was very proud of her decision, although she was reversed in part by the Court of Appeals. And that's because she thought it was the right thing to do. She thought that it was wrong to relegate prisoners to solitary confinement in this way, that it was psychologically damaging, that it was cruel and unusual. And I will say that Motley was a trailblazer in that respect, and that she was ahead of her time. You know, these days, quite a few advocates have come around to her position, but at the time, it was viewed as an extraordinary decision that conferred rights upon imprisoned individuals when a lot of people didn't think that that prisoners should have constitutional rights. The other two cases were sex discrimination cases, one involving Melissa Ludke, who was a sports journalist who was barred from the clubhouse of the New York Yankees during the World Series. She sued on grounds that it was sex discrimination, unlawful, that she was not being allowed to do her work on the same terms as male journalists. Motley drew that case and decided in favor of Ludke. Again, it was a very controversial case. The combination of gender, a woman sports journalist, sort of viewed as invading a male prerogative, was deeply controversial. But Motley, again, was proud of it. She thought it was sort of an open and shut case. This woman not being able to do her job because of her gender. And then there was the Blank versus Sullivan and Cromwell case, which involved female law school graduates who challenged the policies of this prestigious law firm in a case where the women alleged that they were not hired as they should have been, they were not promoted, and the off chance that they were hired, all because of their gender. And Motley drew the case and actually had to contend with a motion by the law firm's counsel to recuse herself on the grounds that because she had been a civil rights lawyer and because she was a woman herself who likely had been subject to discrimination, that she had no business actually presiding in the case. Motley rejected this motion, saying that, well, actually, there was no showing of actual prejudice on her part, and that all judges come to the bench with a background, with a practice background, with a gender and a race. It was not exclusive to her, and it was an extraordinary opinion that is still cited today for the proposition that counsel can't just target women or people of color judges for recusal merely on the basis of their identity. And then Motley went on to rule in favor of a settlement that on behalf of women lawyers that opened the door to female lawyers in those prestigious and lucrative law firms. And of course, given her own experience, it was coming full circle, you might say, for Motley. She had been denied employment opportunities, and then she ended up being the judge to interpret the Civil Rights Act in a way that conferred opportunity on others. And so a kind of a sweet victory.
That it was. As we wrap up, what would you consider to be the most important components of Motley's legacy, and what do you want readers to take away from the book?
Yes, well, I would say that if one asks the question of where was Motley most impactful, her career as a civil rights lawyer was unparalleled, and she, along with the other lawyers who litigated cases such as Brown versus Board of Education, all of the higher education cases, and civil rights cases in many other areas, voting, housing, etc., really changed the world and changed the law in a way that in context should be understood as quite radical change. And so that those cases certainly are among her greatest legacy, changing the world for all of us, creating a regime where segregation by law fell. And this after, at a time when, and under circumstances where it just would not have been thought possible given the precedent of Plessy versus Ferguson. Her impact on the bench is also an important part of her legacy. She was a history maker. She created opportunity, as I've described, for other women, particularly in the professions. She also created a legacy as a working mother who was also a professional that continues to resonate with audiences. I've talked about this book to audiences, including law firm associates and partners. And unfortunately, many of them still experience struggle around being a parent and being a professional. And it is terrific to have been able to write a book about someone who was able to break a barrier there. And then, of course, there is the theme that I discuss in my book of being a barrier breaker as an African American, and being able to achieve quite a lot as a symbol of change and a representative of change. She became a representative of the state when she had spent her career attacking the decision-making of state actors. And so that is both remarkable, but also, as I describe in my book, she was only able to do so much as a judge because of norms of professionalism, because of the eventual backlash against civil rights advancers. And so ultimately the legacy is one of personal achievement, but it's mixed in terms of the changes that the progressive movements themselves were able to achieve under the law. The women's movement, the civil rights movement, anti-poverty movement, all ran up against resistance. And that too is a part of Motley's legacy. She personifies that backlash against the civil rights and women's rights movements.
That she does. Thank you so much, Dean Brown Nagin, for joining me today to discuss Constance Baker Motley. Readers, please go out and pick up a copy of Civil Rights Queen to learn about this pathbreaking woman who is a tireless warrior, I want to say, for a social joy, for social justice. Dean Brown Nagin, thank you again. Thank you again for joining me today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.